90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. Have a great program for you today. Our guest will be one of the truly dominant intellectuals of the past 60 years in the United States, and a figure that needs no introduction. Gore Vidal will be our guest for the full hour. But before we go to our guest, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
I am convinced that there are few goals more essential in the communications landscape than preserving and maintaining an open and robust Internet.
The future of an open internet got a whole lot brighter this week. On Monday, Federal Communications Commission Chairman Julius Genachowski delivered a landmark speech in which he called for new rules to protect net neutrality, the longstanding principle that bars internet service providers from blocking or slowing any lawful content on the web.
Some have argued that the FCC should not take affirmative steps to protect the internet's openness. Let me be clear about what this is about and what it isn't. The fundamental goal of what I've outlined today is preserving the openness and freedom of the internet. We have an obligation to ensure that the internet is an enduring engine for U.S. economic growth and a foundation for democracy in the 21st century. We have an obligation to ensure that the internet remains a vast landscape of innovation and opportunity. This is not about government regulation of the internet. It's about fair rules of the road for companies that control access to the internet.
While open internet advocates cheered the move, internet service providers immediately spoke out against the idea. Verizon's Vice President of Regulatory Affairs, David Young, voiced his company's concerns in a panel at the Brookings Institution that immediately followed the chairman's speech.
The concern is that, you know, these are regulations that would apply to the internet now for the very first time. The FCC has studiously avoided regulating ISPs in any way, shape, or form since the inception of the internet, and this would represent the first rules ever written to apply to the internet, and I think there's a concern that there could be unintended consequences of doing that.
Also on the panel was Ben Scott, policy director of Free Press, who disagreed with Young's assessment.
This notion that the internet has no regulations in and around the market is total nonsense. Spam is regulated, interconnection rules are regulated, prices in the special access market are regulated, there's a proposal to put universal service underneath broadband, that is a massive regulatory system. The internet is becoming an infrastructure. It is inevitably going to have a regulatory structure around it. What we're deciding is not, will it have a regulatory structure, what we're deciding is, what is it going
the
to look like,
and
what
on
is
this
its
program
purpose,
are
what
those
will its
of the
outcomes
host
be,
and
whose interests will they serve.
Commissioners Mignon Clyburn and Michael Copps have also endorsed Genachowski's plan,
Greetings.
Giving him a majority at the
Matters.
FCC. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi immediately released a statement of support, followed by many other prominent members of Congress. And at a speech in Troy, New York, President Obama weighed in as well.
Another key to strengthening education, entrepreneurship, and innovation in communities like Troy is to harness the full power of the internet. And that means faster and more widely available broadband, as well as rules to ensure that we preserve the fairness and openness that led to the flourishing of the internet in the first place. So today, FCC Chairman Julius Genachowski is announcing a set of principles to preserve an open internet in which all Americans can participate and benefit. And I'm pleased that he's taking that step. That's an important role that we can play.
Monday's announcement came on the heels of a bill in Congress, the Internet Freedom Preservation Act, that was introduced earlier this year by Massachusetts Representative Edward Markey and California's Anna Eshoo. Misty Perez Trudson is a campaign coordinator at Free Press and SaveTheInternet.com. With the preceding opening at the FCC and a bill moving forward in Congress, Perez Trudson says the phone and cable industry will be gearing up for the fight of their lives.
This is a chance for us to preserve and protect an open internet once and for all. And the telcos see a closed internet as a way for them to increase their profits and a way for them to gain lockdown and control over the internet. So absolutely, they're going to be scrambling to do everything they can to not only defeat the rulemaking at the FCC, but also to defeat the legislation in Congress, which is why we need more than ever for the public to stand up and demand an open internet through net neutrality protections at the FCC and through the Internet Freedom Preservation Act in Congress.
But if Janikowski's speech on Monday is any indication, Washington may finally be recognizing that the internet's open architecture is at the heart of its role in spurring economic growth, free speech, and innovation.
We are here because 40 years ago, a bunch of researchers in a lab changed the way computers interact, and as a result, changed the world. We are here because those internet pioneers had unique insights about the power of open networks to transform lives for the better, and they did something about it. Our work now is to preserve the brilliance of what they contributed to our country and the world.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, our guest is someone who needs no introduction. He's been a guest before and I think is probably known to all our listeners. If he's not, they're in for a real treat today. Gore Vidal, American novelist, screenwriter, playwright, essayist, politician, actor, you name it, he's done it over the past six decades, joins us today for an interview. He comes to us from his home in Los Angeles. Mr. Vidal, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, thank you. In Urbana, as it were, again.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
How's the Champagne Gazette doing?
Like most newspapers, the same general experience is going on there.
That is, I believe, is the word we always search for now when it comes to the press.
Indeed. And, you know, it's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the program and always enjoy having you among many is that when I was a young man, I'm dating myself now, but in the 1960s, I became aware of you and was familiar with you before I started reading any of your books when I was just in my early teens, because you were not an uncommon guest on some of the programs like the Johnny Carson Show, the Merv Griffin Show, Mike Douglas Show, shows like this that were the equivalent of the Oprah Winfrey shows of today, or the Jay Leno program. And you would talk oftentimes about fairly serious issues. These weren't just sort of talking about what you ate for breakfast the day before. And I remember, I think it was in 1967, Washington, D.C., your novel had just been published, and you were on either Merv Griffin or Mike Douglas, one of those programs, and you described the United States as an empire, like Rome. And to me, a then 14-year-old middle-class boy from suburban Cleveland, I'd never heard the United States described that way. It was just astonishing. And it really forced me at that early age to sort of rethink what our country was about and its role in the world. And the reason I raise that is that people like you aren't on programs like that anymore. Issues like that aren't raised on programs like that anymore. And it seems to me that, this is a real problem of our media culture and our political culture, that ideas like that have been put off to the margins.
Well, they're meant to be. I mean, nothing is accidental in this world. And I can remember my years ago, my first volume of essays, when it was published by Random House, and just collected pieces. I've been doing them for the last year or two. And Time Magazine decided to strike because God knows Henry Luce regarded himself as the keeper of the American flame. And did a lot of damage because it was all idiosyncratic journalism and it was his likes and dislikes. He used to love to attack Tennessee Williams, whom he regarded as decadent. And I finally asked him once on the air, what do you think the word means? He didn't have a clue. He just knew it was probably a ferry. So that would be bad enough, so he'd be home free. And it was awful stuff. But time went out of their way when the first book of essays came out of mine. It said, well, he's the sort of critic who doesn't understand anything about the United States, referring to me, because he refers to the United States as an empire. I thought that was the whole point of what I was doing, but no grasp of it. So with guardians like that, you know, the sacred flame is always going to be slightly off color.
You know, in the past decade or 9 years since the George W. Bush administration took power in Washington, the notion of empire sort of got a little more play, and not necessarily as a bad thing that the United States was assuming this role. It became a more commonly used term. And to people on the left and to liberals and progressives, the Bush administration, for many of them, seen as something that's sort of out of the pattern of U.S. politics, sort of this awful, crazy turn that American politics turn away from sort of the normal trajectory of our country. And with the election of Obama, we're back on track to the good country we should be and have been and usually are. What's your sense of that type of thinking?
Well, it's not my type of thinking, but I see what you mean. Yes. Whether to go back to the days of Boss Tweed or the heyday of Tammany Hall, and as a New York politician at that time, this is back in, I'll think of a date for it, but when I was doing a lot of television, and I was sent by Tammany Hall. I was happy to be allied with him, as Carmine DiSapio was running it then. And it was more good than bad, and certainly for the liberal cause. And I was, suddenly the word came, would I like to go to the Democratic Convention, which is going to be meeting soon? And I said, yes, I would. And they said, well, knowing Tammany, I said, well, what am I supposed to do? They said, well, what you do anyway, you would vote for Jack Kennedy to be nominated for the party's presidential candidate. And I said, yes, I would. And that's all you have to do. So I went out to Los Angeles, where I now sit staring out the window and chatting with you. And thinking about politics, as I'm about in a week or so, I'm going to be introducing George McGovern inside one of the few buildings large enough to hold his audience, which is the Reagan Library in Simi Valley. And Senator McGovern rang me and said, would I introduce him? I said, how do I explain what the two of us are doing in the Reagan Library? He said, that'll give you a good opening, Gore. It's a good opening. So we'll see what I do.
Our guest today in Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is Gore Vidal, the author, essayist, playwright, screenwriter, historian. Joining us for this program, it's pre-recorded, so please don't call and sit back, relax. Let us do the talking. One of the ways you've influenced several generations of Americans has been with your historical work. I remember when Burr came out, I believe in the early 1970s, one of my friends got a copy and it was read by all of us. It was almost like a virus that spread so quickly, and it introduced American history to a generation, to my generation, in a way we hadn't really learned it in schools before.
I was trying to take it away from my school.
Yeah, and you did a good job of that. You know, what would you say, Gore Vidal, you know, about our history, especially the founding of the Republic, has been lost to the current generation or to the people today, that they don't really, what we misunderstand about our past, at least in sort of conventional wisdom or common media chatter?
Well, seem to hate it. And, you know, whatever it is that we do of a major nature must be highly praised, because we're the greatest nation in the country, as Spiro Agnew used to say. And it's, well, between, you know, insane hyperbole about how great we are, and I often point out, somebody said to me on some program not long ago, they said, everybody wants to come here. I said, well, when was the last time you saw a Norwegian with a green card wanting work in the United States? I said, people don't come here. We get a lot of people that we have despoiled. I mean, use an old-fashioned word, south of our borders. And there are a lot of poor people who come up from there to work, carrying our loads, as it were, and burning the trash. But that isn't true immigration. That is just overflow or displaced people. And we should be perhaps more kindly about them than we have been, but instead we treat them as dreadful pariahs, which is insane, as we're going to need more and more population, as we don't seem to be breeding fast enough.
The one of the things about the Constitution, you've written about the founders and Madison and Jefferson and Adams and Washington. And from my own work, too, it's been clear that, at least in the case of Madison and I think in the others, there was a genuine concern about the power of the state being too great, the government's power being too large, and how militarism could enhance that concern tremendously, especially by Madison. Yet today the United States sits as this military empire. Does our Constitution make possible what exists? I mean, is there a contradiction between the Constitution as written and what exists in the United States today in terms of military power?
Well, no. The Constitution as written is pretty sparse, and it doesn't really tell you an awful lot. And it takes for granted that you, the reader, as somebody who's interested in the origins of the Constitution, in other words, in the Federalist Papers, which preceded the writing of it in 1789, the founders presupposed that you knew all the arguments against, let us say, having a standing army, that we ought not to have one. And we were in a situation that we had no, the Indians were not enraged at us and were not marching against us. The French and the, Spanish, who were enemies for a long time, were relatively quiet. And so we were basically at peace, but the back of it was the notion that we were a sort of quiet, mind-its-own-business republic that considered itself, luckily, outside the rules of world commerce and world empire. And we had such a lot of territory to begin with. We were not looking around for more space until, of course, we were. And that all came about in the 1840s when people like President Polk, who was a busy politician in those days, and he had his eye on California, which he thought should belong to the American. I think he used the word empire occasionally. Some people used it, some people didn't. And suddenly we got active in the 1840s. And a couple of things happened. One was we lost a very interesting political party. We've never had many political parties that meant anything. They were mostly slogans to, you know, get a border crook like Andrew Jackson in a position where he can award to his various friends from the border banks, because he's a against the Bank of America, the Biddle family. And out of Jackson came a whole imperial view of the United States, that we're now filling up the continent, our section of it. And meanwhile, eyes were on Mexico, and we were getting awfully busy. To no great end. The democracy thing that we keep babbling about, we've never tried it. We've disliked it every time we saw it, you know, an opportunity to become more democratic. It was never for us. But it played awfully well in unfortunate countries, of which there were a great many from time to time. And then we had one truly batty president. I mean, we've had quite a few of them lately, but we had one who was just bats, and that was Woodrow Wilson. And he was, my grandfather made him president two times, not just once. And Senator Gore, what he called, he had invented something called Oklahoma. Wit of that sort always ran in our family. And as the inventor of Oklahoma, he represented the West. The West was organizing itself. The Civil War had come and gone, and the South was a wreck. And they were pulling themselves together, and Mr. Gore quietly began to organize in northern Mississippi something called the Party of the People, which was a logical thing for a society that likes to think of itself as a unique form of democracy. Then when he had immortal longings, and he wanted to go abroad and throw his weight around as a poet president and make the world safe for democracy. If there's ever been a stupider slogan, that was it. And the real Americans, like Senator Gore, just said, "You're crazy," and kept reminding Mr. Wilson of the founders of the country, particularly Madison, to whom you already alluded, who warned against maintaining a military base on the ground. As he pointed out, if you had such a thing, you'd use it. And he saw imperial days on the horizon, and so they came. And we thought we were defended by the Monroe Doctrine, which, curiously enough, was not the work of President Monroe, but of his Secretary of State. Going on in the country, you can figure that an Adams is at work somewhere, complaining. They were great complainers. They were very brilliant men, and they certainly were anti-imperial. In fact, it was Charles Francis Adams, son of the great John Quincy. No, it was the great John Quincy who became president. And he came up with a quotation which I often use, and just because nobody in America seems to know it. He was one of the obscure presidents, which was a pity because he was one of the most brilliant. And it was he, in fact, who wrote the Monroe Doctrine for his president, who had picked him as Secretary of State. But it was the attitude was, now let's see if I can get the quote straight. Around 1824, Mr. Adams gave a 4th of July speech in the great tradition. He made the eagle scream and so on. But he said he had been asked, would the United States come over to Europe and help the Greeks free themselves from the Turks? And we were all pro-Turks in the United States because our men of letters and statesmen were all classicists and believed in the values of Pericles and so forth. And that seemed to be something that would suit a great scholar like Adams. But when confronted with the request for troops to go abroad and help the Greeks in their battle against the Turks, he said something which should have been our watchword from that moment on, but wasn't, because he'd lost an ugly election and he was under a cloud. But he said, the United States is not a nation that goes, a paladin that goes forth into foreign wars to fight them overseas or wherever occasion may demand. He said, were we such a nation, we could easily become the mistress of the world, but in the process we would lose our soul. So much for foreign adventures. And then, of course, we get Woodrow Wilson with the First World War, which was a ghastly experience for the United States, and showing what, if you let presidents out of their box, they will go off and commit horrors. We had a grotesque example with Mr. Bush, who was something so dreadful that there's nothing in the Constitution for him. I kept thinking, when are they going to come up with, this is the middle of the Bush mess, with a recall movement, just get him out of there, because he was antagonizing every ally we had. And we were palpably going broke with all of his war. I'm wartime president. Babble. He would go on, and no one told him, oh, you're not wartime. Only Congress can declare the war. That is when we jettison the Constitution in the interest of a half-mad little president of extraordinary ignorance who was only behaving to make money for his oil friends in Texas, not the most savory group of people in the United States.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Gore Vidal. He's joining us on the phone from Los Angeles. We're pre-recording this program, so please don't try to call in. Just sit back and relax and let us do the talking. Mr. Vidal, today the United States spends roughly $1 trillion a year on military, if you factor in the interest and all the various war expenses that get spread around the budget. Over half the spending in the world is done by the United States. We have hundreds of bases all over the world and scores of countries. This is not a rhetorical question. Is there a way that a country like the United States can walk away from being that type of empire, have sort of a peaceful, soft landing? Or is this thing so hardwired into the United States at this point that it's going to be almost unchangeable without some sort of dreadful political cataclysm?
Well, the dreadful political hassle we got with the Bush people, the first thing that they did, and it was fascinating, horrifying also to watch Bush and that crazy little attorney general of his.
Gonzalez.
For the first time in our history, we had an attorney general whose job it was, whenever Congress passed a law, that he would immediately organize the Justice Department to find a way to get around it so that his sovereign, George W. Bush, could break the law at will. And they got down, it became voodoo after a while. They had something, a whispered comment from the president could nullify anything that Congress had passed. Now, this was unheard of. There are three great balances in our government, and God knows the legislative is basically the most important. But there they were, and desperately trying to make sure that nothing that might be displeasing to the money friends of Mr. Bush and company could be got rid of. Without due process of law, they got rid of that very early. They got rid of practically everything that we have had since Magna Carta, which is the only nice thing the British ever left us when they decided to move out of North America. So the one safeguard we had was Magna Carta, and they got rid of that. And suddenly there we were adrift on a strange sea of really anti-Americanism, if you want to say that there is such a thing. And I believe there is, except it's a word that is used, you know, to justify the deeds of bad men and women.
Do you believe the election of Obama and the return of the Democrats to power in the White House and really controlling both branches of Congress has pretty much put a stop to that dark chapter in our history? Have we turned the page to a much brighter era now?
No, we haven't, and Obama has been a great disappointment in my view. You know, it's nice to have somebody with above average intelligence instead of a bunch of people with below average. I mean the Bush family particularly. And then we had a crazed sort of vice president who was just grabbing power right and left and trying to govern underneath the president himself. And this was a strange state of affairs. Nothing like that had ever happened in the United States before that. And to have a vice president and another president and everybody else condone torture, I've been reading the papers lately, and it's all coming out. Yes, they just loved it, you know. And I can remember at the time when Congress was faced with some torture bills, because they'd invented a couple of stories. One was Saddam Hussein was the most evil man since Adolf Hitler, and we must get him. So we got him. He was no danger to the United States at all. We pretend that 9/11 was his work. It wasn't his work. 9/11 was the work of some religious fanatics, and we never did get them. Every trick that you could do to make a simple-minded people, if you don't mind my saying that about the American people, they are dumber than most people. Our educational system is the worst of any first-world country, and everybody's sort of behind. Nobody's interested in politics. Nobody's interested in the United States. There's very little interest in our institutions and how we got them, how to preserve them. Everything was done to make sure that people of property kept it and got more, and that nothing ever got back to the people at large, because who are they? One thing that the Bush people made, they made respectable, reversing all of the safeguard laws of the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt. And it's marvelous to see them get away with it, but this is what happens when you don't have a free media. I'm not saying that you should put out newspapers that, you know, are given away in the shopping mall. But that might be better than having them owned by Henry Luce and a lot of other maniacs along the way who are going to make sure that the people do never know what's happened in their name.
Has the news media changed significantly over the course of your lifetime in terms of the quality or quantity, or has it pretty much been the same old story?
Well, no, it hasn't been the same old story. I mean, we've never had anything like the last dozen years in which, as I said, you have an attorney general whose principal task is to make certain that the Constitution does not apply to the laws of the land as promulgated in this era. Anything the president comes up with is law. Well, we have Richard Nixon's immortal lines: if the president do it, it just isn't wrong. That was That was really a bright one. So we are left denuded. We don't have the Bill of Rights anymore, which is badly damaged. I think we can restore it, but it disturbs me that Obama, who after all was a constitutional professor of the Constitution anyway, at Harvard, never says a word about the restoration of the Constitution. If I were a liberal Democrat who got to be president in a period in which Bush and Cheney were governing what was in effect a totalitarian government, and that was their attitude, this whole place must obey the president of the United States, and we got the White House, we're the president. And where Obama has been particularly disturbing, one is he takes on the wars, which have ruined us in practically every sense. He takes them on. The first thing he says after he's become safely president, he's in favor of we've got to defeat Afghanistan. Well, we don't have to defeat Afghanistan. I would think that, you know, Cape Verde could probably defeat us by now because we've wrecked the military. And I say this not as a pacifist, crypto-pacifist, member of the American liberal wing of the Democratic Party. I speak this as somebody who was born at West Point, whose father was West Point, whose brothers was West Point, whose uncle was West Point. We all served in the military. And although my eyes were never good enough for me to rise in that army, I did go into World War II with great misgivings. I thought the war was a total mistake for us. And it wasn't about liberating the Jews, the Gypsies, the French, this, the that. These were good things to do, and these are good things that came out of it. But that's not what it was about, ever. Look at the propaganda from those days. It sets the teeth on edge.
What was the war about, World War II?
Money. Things were pretty... The New Deal had come out of the Great Depression in the early 1930s. And Roosevelt was very fortunate in that his advisors, you know, he was no economist himself, but he had excellent instincts. And suddenly they were trying to put together a wrecked economy, rather than what we've been going through in the post-Bush era here. Try and make the banks function and lend money again and all those things which are deemed as, you know, advisable and admirable. Well, the war came out of, actually, we can genuinely and not in a demonizing way blame Hitler for it. It was Roosevelt's genius as a politician to realize that Hitler was not another Kaiser. He was not another Bismarck, who were relatively civilized men. He was something new under the sun. He was totalitarian. And you see traces of it in Roosevelt, because it was in the air. These things are like swine flu. I mean, they get in the air, and everybody catches it. And suddenly people behave fighting against their own interests. One of the miracles of the American form of government is that year after year, decade after decade, century after century, we're able to persuade the people to vote against their own interests. Imagine all this fight when we have more, we've thrown away all the money we had for military. We don't have it anymore. And yet it's anathema to see these porky people go screeching from one mall to another, screaming they don't want socialism. They don't know what socialism is. They haven't any idea what anything is because the educational system won't tell them. And they can't read on their own. And if they did, there are too many propagandists out there preaching the word. We get a lot of the word of Jesus, but we don't get much of the word of Thomas Jefferson, whom I'd rather be listening to.
Our guest, Gaurav Vidal. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. This program was pre-recorded, so please don't try to call in. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. And speaking of religion, which you've just gone to, you wrote a play many years ago called The Best Man, which I didn't have an opportunity to see, but I saw the film version with Henry Fonda playing a candidate for president or the president of the United States. And there was a scene in there, like that first anecdote I told at the top of the show, that stuck with me because you had a comment where the subject of religion came up for these various political candidates, and the president sort of turned to his aide and said, or someone said, well, of course, I'm an atheist, we all are, but we have to have the pretense of being religious, you know, to get votes. And
What,
I can't remember the exact wording. I'm paraphrasing.
He said that to an aide, but no, he said the good guy played by Henry Fonda, sort of telling the truth as he sees it about politics. And this is very refreshing to a lot of people. And it's the heart of liberalism. You know, if you don't know where you've been as a country, you'll never know where you're going. We have no idea where we've been, except we're the greatest nation in the country, Spiro Agnew would say. And for some reason, everybody hates us. Well, if you are capturing people at random on the far fields of Bactria, on the edge of India, and mailing them back to Guantanamo Bay and torturing them, and torture is now legitimate. I mean, everybody talks quite openly about, well, you see, if we didn't have that, you get the wonderful rationale, we would never have been able to find out about 9/11. Well, as it was, we didn't find out in time. Some people did. Some of the elements of the CIA had us pretty well informed about that we were going to have unfriendly visitors from the skies. And things could have been done, but between the greed, the desire to make money, the one thing that people wonder, I've spent much of my life in Europe, particularly in Italy, where my family came from, at one point in our history in the 19th century, and they sort of wondered, what were we up to? When we had no health care for the people. Well, we know that's communist. I mean, my God, that's communism. And you get this honking from people who don't know communism from who knows what, the planet Neptune. They are that far out of civilization. And I'm not proud of that. The fact that the United States has done relatively well, or had done relatively well before the Bush adventures, wrecked the military, wrecked the economy, and left us hanging in limbo with no Bill of Rights. That was one of the first things that had to be erased by the little attorney general working for the tiny president. Did much of anybody bother then? I don't really remember. Ordinarily, we would have had, you know, great, great legal figures saying, you can't do that. You're just trying dispensing with the Fourth Amendment. You can't go around knocking into people's houses and so forth. Well, they can. They wanted to, and they did. We've got a police force now that is the terror of the earth. They're all armed. They should not be armed. England has a fraction of the crime we do and much the same sort of a population. And their police are not armed. But ours are armed to the teeth. We so show the example of a professor who got arrested up at Harvard in his own house. Only in America could something so stupid have happened. And only in America would we have a president who was so craven that instead of knocking the police on the head in Cambridge, Massachusetts, he just let it go. Well, let's all have a beer and just talk things over. And isn't that nice? Well, it's not very nice, and it's very stupid. And then as far as going back to his predecessors and all of the affronts that they had delivered against the Constitution of the United States, well, let's move ahead, says Obama. My thought was, quite a brilliant man. But he's terrified of the system, and he wants to be reelected. I think he's going to have trouble because he was elected to end the war. They're not over. First thing he did, 17,000 active troops to the Middle East, to Afghanistan, which is no national interest of ours. Hard to explain that to people who think the entire world is ours. There's signs that the people are getting the point that it's such a cost. There is no educational system that is worthwhile for the general public. We're not even taught American history, much less world history. And we just sit by and perpetrate myths about ourselves and how beloved we are. And everybody's jealous of us. Everybody wants to come. To hear Americans talk about America, you'd think envy was the principal emotion of all human beings. It is possible at one level that in a world that's starving, that could be. But the world wasn't starving when we got the Bush gang. But they wanted more money, and so they began to rent troops to a military that was already broken, and I speak is somebody who takes very seriously the fact he was born at West Point.
Gore Vidal, how would you compare Obama, from what you've seen of him, to, say, Bill Clinton or Jimmy Carter, the last two Democratic presidents?
Well, they were better politicians than Obama. I mean, he doesn't put a foot right very often. He's eloquent, which is rather good for a country that is governed by the magic of the human voice, starting with Roosevelt. Roosevelt was a master politician who was also one able to persuade people, like Demosthenes, you know. You felt when he spoke, he was saying, his voice was telling you, let us march. That is how he got us through the Depression and brought on many good things. I remember when Social Security came up in the Senate, my grandfather, President Pro Tem, of that August by. And it was, the Republican Party was true to form back then, as it still is true to form. So suddenly there was the issue of old folks should put away money in the Social Security Fund, which would later be used when they were old folks, to create a machine that would help them survive instead of going to the poorhouse, which is what happened before. The Republican Party, I went down to the Senate with my grandfather on the day that the vote was about to be taken on Social Security. And Senator Gore introduced it in the opera, and Huey Long, the great Huey Long, seconded it. And we went down to the Senate, and there was just consternation, particularly on the Republican side. And they said, they firmly believed, they had a lot of placards around the Capitol, that if Social Security passed, the average American would automatically lose his name in exchange for a number. That would be the end of our freedom. This was just brilliant, you know. And if you have a political party, well, I was going to dignify that group as, you know, being a political party. They're not. Republican problem, and they are beginning to face it. They're worrying that they may be meaningless. Well, of course they're meaningless because they're a mindset. They hate the later arrivals in the United States. They hate some of the indigenous peoples here. They're just full of hatred. And this has done them no good, and they're so surprised that they're not beloved by all. And if we had decent history departments in the schools, we could have taught the people enough American history to know when a party or a group of people goes off the rails. And we would be much more aware of what is wrong and why we're in the trouble we are.
You wrote a highly acclaimed book on Lincoln, and so you know a great deal about the origins of the Republican Party. Has the Republican Party always been the party that you described in the 1930s through to the present day, or was it something different in its first incarnation?
Well, the malefactors of great wealth, as Franklin Roosevelt called the Republican leaders, he wasn't terribly polite about the opposition. And they blocked everything that they could. And sometimes they got away with it, and sometimes they didn't. And every now and then they would have the luck to pick a kind of movie star to run for president. Hence they got General Eisenhower. And later Ronald Reagan, who was not as serious a figure, but it was, after all, Eisenhower warned us against the military-industrial complex, which was taking over the United States. And it's taking over everything. People said, well, these are just military appropriations. That isn't taking over everything. Well, it's taking over the universities instead of free science. And Eisenhower, in his famous speech to the end of his career, made it very clear it permeates everything, the military-industrial complex. Everything is for war. Well, how can you get the people revved up to give all their tax money for wars in countries that we know nothing about? Well, you can do it by telling lies. And by then we had a press which was just incapable of telling the truth about anything to the extent it understood what truth was, as opposed to invention. Clever lies is by what we've been living through most of my career, political career. You can be sure if it's in the press being played big, it's probably not true. It is to somebody's interest. Halliburton, if you happen to be in the vice president's Cheney's camp, renting stuff out at a huge cost, bankrupting costs to the nation. And they've done a great job of breaking the Treasury open. Anybody complain? Nobody complain. We've just got to look ahead. This is what I loathe in Obama. I mean, he's always just looking ahead. He thinks these people are going to like him, that he can reason with them. He can't reason with them. These are predatory animals that go back to the very dawn of the country, when we were busy killing off the indigenous population of the so-called Indians. And we just kept at it and kept at it, and we're still keeping at it.
Our guest today, Gore Vidal. We've only got a few minutes left here on Media Matters. And again, to remind our listeners, this is a recorded program, so please don't try to call in. Just sit back and relax and let us enjoy the show. You know, one of the issues, Gore Vidal, that progressives, people on the left, liberals have wrestled with is getting people to run for office. Running for office today in the United States is so much like being a Broadway producer, trying to raise money constantly. You actually have twice now run for Congress, first in New York State for a House seat in 1960, and then for the Democratic nomination for U.S. Senator in 1982. What did you learn from those experiences?
I didn't learn anything. I confirmed what I already knew, how it was done. I was brought up in the House of a man who was for more than 30 years senator from a brand new state that he had brought into the Union called Oklahoma. And he was a great teacher. He was too stern for his constituency. You know, Oklahoma was a really wild state. Luckily, I wasn't stuck with that. But I ran in California. Before that, I ran in New York, the state in which I was born. And I found that if you just talk reasonable sense to the people, they're very quick to see their interests, but you've got to wedge yourself between the media and reality. This is not easy, and everything in the society is telling the lies. I'd say the most startling thing of my public life has been, and I've had a lot of public life, if not public office, the public life has been the extent to which everybody's lying. This is something that was somebody of a combination of West Point and, I suppose, the old America. You don't lie. Well, if you do, you're bound to get caught. So it's just there are practical reasons for not lying. That seemed to go by the board.
When do you think that happened?
The Empire. Communism was on the march. It wasn't on the march anywhere. But you couldn't tell a bunch of hysterics trying to get a hold of Treasury money to rearm. We're always rearming against some terrible, terrible enemy. I can remember when, the man whose head we pulled off, Saddam Hussein, was the greatest menace to the United States since Hitler. A, Hitler wasn't a menace. He became one because we picked a war with him, for which I think most of us are grateful that we did, because we helped end his regime before it spread any further. But by and large, there we were out there with a totally ignorant population. It's just amazing. I go around to the schools, I go around the universities, I do this, I do that. Generally just asking questions. And I'm stunned by what they don't know. Also, something which seems to be a problem in the United States. We began as a country of rather bright people. At least in action, we were pretty bright. And we were inventive, and invented literally a lot of things, made the weather for a lot of the world. And what I note now, mostly among the young, is beginning to change a bit. But the absence of curiosity is the first sign of the coming dictatorship.
And you see an absence of curiosity among the young?
Yes. Well, the old too.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, Gore Vidal, our time is running out. I'm being signaled that it's time to clear out of the studio. I can't thank you enough for taking an hour out of your day to join us today on Media Matters. Again, thank you very much, Gore Vidal.
Okay, thank you.
Good luck with everything. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thank you all very much, listeners. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for the Champaign-Urbana area, mostly sunny today with a high of 78 degrees. Tonight will be mostly cloudy and there's a 40% chance of showers and isolated thunderstorms, low about 52. Monday mostly sunny, windy and cooler with a high of 65. And Monday night mostly clear with a low of 43. This is Illinois Public Media WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.